What are the prospects for progressive change within the confines of the current political system? Is Britain's Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn a genuine leader of the people who can challenge the dominance of corporatism and imperialism? Did Bernie Sanders ever represent a threat to the Democratic Party establishment, or is he somehow reinforcing the elitist elements within its ranks? Could presidential candidate Jill Stein and the Green Party yet function as a conduit for the energies of thousands of Sanders supporters disenchanted by both of the mainline candidates in this November's presidential elections? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, as Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump secure their roles as their respective parties' presidential nominees, we look at the examples of three modern-day political leaders signaling promise for meaningful political change. We will hear from Commonwealth scholar and commentator Binoy Campmark about Jeremy Corbyn, the recently elected leader of Britain's Labour Party, and then we will hear fellow radio host and commentator Stephen Lendman talk about lessons learned from the U.S. presidential election campaign trail. On today's show, Jeremy Corbyn versus Bernie Sanders versus Jill Stein, prospects for real change? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 10th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, unoccupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Trump was the last GOP aspirant left standing after all others dropped out, an unlikely choice, a surprise winner prevailing despite party bosses opposing him. Democrat power brokers chose Clinton before primary caucus season began. The race was over before it started. Voters in November get to choose between a dirty business-as-usual billionaire racist demagogue and a recklessly dangerous neocon racketeer, war criminal, Wall Street tool, she-devil, fascist rule prevailing either way. Both candidates represent pure evil. That comes from the article, Democracy is Pure Fantasy, Trump versus Clinton in November, by Stephen Lendman, posted June 8th. Canada's foreign policy duplicity is also inherent in its support of another illegal government, that of the neo-Nazi-infested regime, offspring of the Western orchestrated coup that deposed the elected government of President Yanukovych. George Friedman, founder and CEO of Stratfor Intelligence, described the coup as, quote, the most overt coup in history, unquote. More recently, our duplicity was in full view when Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan stated publicly that Assad must go. This despite the fact that engineering regime change in a sovereign foreign country contradicts international law, despite the fact that Canada's previous bombing campaign against Syria, now more of a support role, was a clear violation of international law, and despite the fact that the current sanctions levied against Syria are illegal as well. Clearly, Canada's humanitarian proclamations are hollow facades engineered to fool Canadians into thinking that we have a benevolent foreign policy, even as evidence demonstrates the opposite. That comes from the article Governing Through Lies and Deception by Mark Taliano, posted June 8th. According to a news report in the June 7th German economic news Deutsche Wirtschaftsnachrichten, or DWN, headlined Merkel entmachtet BND USA kontrollieren Spionage in Deutschland, or Merkel ousts BND, US to control German espionage. A new law will soon be passed in the German parliament and be approved by Chancellor Angela Merkel, which will make Germany's version of the CIA, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, or BND, nothing more than a branch of the CIA, to such an extreme degree that even U.S. corporate espionage against German companies will become part of that German operation. The independent capacities of the BND will become emasculated, no longer operational under the new law. Quote, in practice, this means that the U.S. intelligence services, the NSA, will be allowed to continue to listen in on every company and every individual in Germany, unquote. This could be part of the West's buildup toward a global war. According to a report issued on June 6th in German Economic News, the German government is preparing to go to war against Russia and has in draft form a Bundeswehr report declaring Russia to be an enemy nation. That comes from the article, Germany's Foreign Intelligence Services, BND, to become branch of America's CIA, by Eric Zeus, posted June 8th. Some scientists believe that golden rice, which has been developed with funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, could help save the lives of around 670,000 children who die each year from vitamin A deficiency and another 350,000 who go blind. Greenpeace and other environmental groups say the claims being made by the pro-golden rice lobby are misleading and are oversimplifying the actual problems in combating vitamin A deficiency. Moreover, they argue that the golden rice program is diverting attention from other, more effective solutions. Many critics regard golden rice as an overhyped Trojan horse that biotechnology corporations and their allies hope will pave the way for the global approval of other, more profitable GMO crops. The Rockefeller Foundation might be regarded as a charitable entity, but its track record indicates it has been very much part of an agenda which facilitates commercial and geopolitical interests to the detriment of indigenous agriculture and local and national economies. That comes from the article, Pro-GMO Lobby, Genetically Engineered Golden Rice. Is this the solution for disease, poverty, and malnutrition? By Colin Todd Hunter, posted June 8th. Jeanette Shannon of Detroit was evicted from her home on June 3rd after a protracted fight against fraudulent real estate interests and the local courts which favor the predatory lenders and the banks. There is a proliferation of similar scenarios across the city stemming from the real estate and banking collapse of 2007-2008, leaving tens of thousands of vacant homes, many of which have been turned over to the unscrupulous developers and the notorious Detroit Land Bank Authority, the DLBA. A number of these so-called real estate developers exploit the situation when they are given preference in purchasing the properties through the Wayne County auction and those conducted by the DLBA. The homes are often sold on land contracts because, despite the ruling class propaganda that Detroit is being revitalized with property values increasing as well as rents, the banks wrote less than 500 mortgages during the entire year of 2015. After purchasing homes on land contracts from these companies, the residents soon discover that there are property tax and other liens on their homes. That comes from the article, Housing Struggle Continues in Detroit, Defying Landlords and Bankers, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted June 8th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. In September of 2015, Great Britain's Labour Party elected anti-war campaigner and democratic socialist Jeremy Corbyn to the party leadership. Mr. Corbyn had campaigned on a number of positions that set him apart from predecessor Tony Blair, infamous for allying himself with George W. Bush at the time of the Iraq War. To get a better idea of who Mr. Corbyn is and how the British establishment might react to his leadership of the official opposition in the British Parliament, I brought in Dr. Binoy Campmark. Dr. Campmark was a Commonwealth scholar at Selwyn College in Cambridge. He lectures at RMIT University in Melbourne and is a frequent contributor to the Global Research website. The following interview was recorded back in September, within days of Corbyn's promotion. I'm joined once again by Binoy Campmark, and today we're going to discuss a little bit about the recent victory by Jeremy Corbyn as the new leader of Britain's Labour Party. So I know you've written extensively on the subject, so I just wanted to, first of all, you know, get your sense. Were you surprised by this victory in any way?
Well, I think many people were surprised by this particular victory for the simple reason that Jeremy Corbyn was considered the rank outsider for quite a considerable period of time. Virtually every other contender had some connection with the Tony Blair legacy, which is very important, the so-called New Labour grouping, if you like, Yvette Cooper, for example, Burnham and so forth. And this particular grouping never expected that someone like Jeremy Corbyn would actually come out, you know, with the numbers. You know, but as it turns out, someone associated roughly with, or very much so with the left faction of the party ended up storming in and taking over the shambles that was left by the previous election, of course, when the Tories did far better than was predicted.
Who is Jeremy Corbyn? Could you tell us a bit about his background?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn has been in the background of, shall we say, Labour administration for many years. He had associations, in fact, with the Greater London Council. He had associations, in fact, you know, with Ken Livingstone, Red Ken, as he will be known to some people. And for many years, London was defined by Red Ken's presence. And Corbyn was in the background. Corbyn was associated with some of the policies connected with that and made a presence by virtue of that. But he was never really a frontline presence in terms of a climber in that associative sense. So what was interesting was to see him become, as it were, so prominent so quickly, which was, I think, a sign, more broadly speaking, of the lack of satisfaction within the party itself.
Mm. Now, he holds a number of positions that I'm not used to seeing among leaders of these the major, what we call developed countries. It's hard to imagine a leader of a major party in Canada holding some of these positions. I'm wondering if there is a specific position that he's taken that seems to have the establishment on edge and is maybe behind the kind of ramping up of the propaganda campaign against him that seems to be already in evidence.
Yes, I think there are a few points to draw out from that question. The first thing is, what is setting people on edge, certainly the establishment on edge? Well, first and foremost, he has taken a very clear stance against austerity, which is the standard dogma that has been ingested wholeheartedly by certainly the European political establishment, the European financial establishment. And he's openly said that this is not the way to go. That's the first thing. So the first thing is the anti-austerity measure. But the second thing that's really riled individuals, and it's evident by the recent controversial responses that were made. One was by an anonymous general within the security establishment who claimed that if Corbyn was to come to power, if he was to be elected, and if he was to trim back the armed forces, there would be a coup, a potential coup, which is an astonishing thing given the fact that supposedly in Britain these sorts of things don't happen. So even that particular statement was regarded with even within conservative ranks, it was regarded with a considerable distaste and worry. So that's just to give you an example about the effect Jeremy Corbyn's presence has. Firstly, you know, anti-austerity. Secondly, trimming back the military. And, of course, the third aspect, which is a corollary of the second, and that is to say he has decided to, should he become leader, to renegotiate, if not withdraw, from the EU. That's maybe a possibility, not sure yet. But the more significant thing is not even the European Union, it's the fact that Britain could renegotiate under Corbyn its position in NATO. And that has really sent, you know, put a cat amongst the pigeons. The very fact that Britain, one of the key members of NATO, one of the, fellow conquistadores with the United States and Middle East adventurism and a range of other failed ventures, this particular suggestion has been quite astonishing. Not to mention the issue, and just links back to the security issue as well, that Corbyn has said that he would like to abandon the Trident program. In other words, initiate that great curse, as it were, and fear of Britain's security establishment, which is unilateral nuclear disarmament. And that's something that has really worried individuals connected with that.
That sounds absolutely remarkable to me. I'm just so used to the idea of we saw with Blair and Bush, shoulder to shoulder going into Iraq. And, I mean, they've been such a dynamic duo, so to speak. I'm wondering, is there an analog to Corbyn on this side of the Atlantic that...
I just don't see that. And for example, when it comes to even in the Canadian context, when we talk about Canadian politics, each of the individuals connected with the political debates show, I don't want to say a consensus, but essentially an agreement about Canada's role in, for example, security arrangements and intelligence gathering and a range of other things. You've got the most extreme variant of that, of course, in Stephen Harper, but then you also have even an individual like Justin Trudeau, for example, is hardly going to rock the boat enormously. There is an understanding at the core of it about Canada's role in North American, shall we say, affairs, and also the North American association, say, with NATO and a range of things. Considering the rest of the continent, if you like, when you can, someone like Bernie Sanders perhaps might be regarded as closer, as an approximate value. But even Sanders doesn't come anywhere close to Corbyn. You just cannot imagine Sanders saying the sorts of things that Corbyn has been saying of late. You cannot imagine the United States abiding by its
nuclear disarmament.
Yes, it's just virtually impossible to envisage, even though, admittedly, the UK example is, even though it would be almost inconceivable to imagine Britain without its nuclear weapons, the thing to still envisage here is that Britain has a little more leeway potentially to make the difference on this. In the United States, it would have to lead to a fundamental revision of its security doctrine for it to, of course, disarm in that way.
Hmm. Well, then how... united is, like, how does the general public responding to Corbyn's victory in the Labour leadership?
This is a very interesting point, and this is something that's it's hard to say on a certain level. One thing is for sure, there is a considerable number of people, and this is evidenced by the fact that the British Labour Party had a huge enrollment, an explosion, if you like, in membership that took place when Corbyn was campaigning for the Labour leadership. And in fact, these were the numbers that got him up. These were the numbers that ended up getting him up in the Labour stakes, a total underestimation on the part of his opponents by individuals like Yvette Cooper and so forth, who just did not envisage him having this support. The very fact that he has this groundswell of support suggests that he is actually far more popular than is perhaps suggested. If he plays his cards well, he may even garner some conservative supporters in due course. Certainly, regarding the Liberal Democrats, many of them will be very impressed because Liberal Democrat voters were very disappointed about what happened with the so-called... the conservative, the Tory-Liberal alliance that took place, of course, previously with Cameron. And this particular Clegg-Cameron alliance was essentially, the sheep-wolf sort of association where the Liberals ended up, or the Liberal Democrats ended up being consumed by Tory policy. So... Corbyn has an enormous scope here to create an impression in the way that his, previous members and associates have not been able to do.
We're so used to here in Canada, and I'm sure the United States, the idea of having somebody that far to the left being electable. It's, I mean, we the the common wisdom is that you have to move to the center because you're just not you're going to alienate too many people. It seems inconceivable, but that somebody with Corbyn's credentials could actually become prime minister. What do you think? Is he electable?
Well, I think the way you frame your question enables me to answer it from a different way, or a different side, rather. And that is to say, and this reminded me, given the announcement recently, of course, that the infamous Australian dark force, the dark eminence of public relations, Lynton Crosby, was and is working with the Stephen Harper campaign. And that is what conservatives have been doing recently and of recent times. The argument is, well, do you want to be softer in your reactionary approach? Do you want to be more generous with refugees and asylum seekers? Do you want to be, you know, more circumspect about who you bomb? But the reality of it is that Crosby's suggestion to Harper has been go full throttle for the extreme measure. In other words, let's move further to the right in order to win the center. So the paradox is, let us be more extreme in order to actually win government. And that seems to be the strategy that David Cameron adopted in the UK, and certainly the strategy that Stephen Harper is doing in the hope that this will end up pushing him across the line. So why not do it from the other side? Why not push oneself to the left in order to be more appealing? So rather than making the mistake of moving to the center, why doesn't the left do in this case what the right are doing, which is to accentuate their tendencies? Rather than being more extremist to the right, let us be more extreme to the left. And this seems to be the Corbyn attitude, not that he's sitting there scrawling away and saying, I want to be more leftist to be appealing. He's simply doing what he's always done. I mean, the thing that's most interesting about Corbyn is that he's essentially sticking to a principles that, and even conservative commentators have admitted this, is that he's one of the few individuals in politics who's never wavered. He's actually very consistent. He's made it very clear he's a Republican. He's made it very clear that he's into unilateral disarmament. You know, he's made it very clear that he is an individual who, yes, he is a patriot in a traditional sort of sense, but he's not a warmonger. He's not going to be going out and unduly deploying the UK forces in the name of foreign expeditions without value. I mean, he's made that clear. So from the start, he's actually made his position clear, which is a very, it may frighten some people, but it's a very attractive position for members of the electorate who finally can see someone who they can vote for and who won't, as Margaret Thatcher said, go wobbly, as it were.
Well, it raises an interesting question because I'm so used to thinking of politics as being about the art of the possible and that compromise is at the heart of politics. So I'm wondering, is down the line, is it possible that Mr. Corbyn can be co-opted in some way?
That's always a possibility. And of course, let's not adopt the heavenly pose here and suggest that he can't, you know, move about in his positioning. And he's not going to, of course, have to make certain compromises. He's not going to go out and abolish Her Majesty's, presence, for example.
Eliminate the monarchy.
Yes, because he himself, in fact, is on record now as suggesting that too many Brits seem to have it, have a certain affection or an interest in Elizabeth II. So there's not going to be a suggestion that he's going to go out and abolish it. But when it comes to certain positions, and as long as he maintains that particular stance, he could be a very powerful force, a very potent force. The question is, of course, whether the spin doctor element get to him. And so far, they haven't gotten to him, which is very interesting. And this is what's frightening. He's not following the PR class, the cast of the PR, the Lynton Crosbys of the world. There's no Lynton Crosby equivalent. He is his own man, which is an astonishing thing in recent politics, because you just don't see that in political operations these days. There's no Alastair Campbell around the corner. There's no, you know, Crosby around the corner. There's no individual equivalent dark Iago giving advice, as it were. And you just don't tend to see that with Corbyn. And may that last. I hope that lasts. It may well change. And I can't, of course, predict the future on that. It may well be that when it comes to the crunch, when it comes to the election campaign, and it's hard to forget, or it's rather easy to forget at the moment, that the person who's running Britain is not Corbyn, it is actually Cameron. The news that's coming out constantly is about what Corbyn's up to. But the reality is that he is not, of course, you know, the Prime Minister of Britain, and he has to deal with people within his own ranks. And that may be the first challenge, actually. The big challenge is to try to scotch the Blairite dissenters, of which there are many, and there's no question about that.
Yeah, I guess I was going to ask how united is the Labour Party behind him? I mean, could some sort of internal civil war doom his chances?
And that will be probably the thing that will do his chances, because at the end of this particular transformation, the question, of course, is how durable that particular, I suppose, a Corbyn ascendancy is. Many of the individuals in his party who initially said, and this is very typical, first they did not think that he would be elected. Then they saw him get elected. Then they started changing their position and saying, well, having said, I will not be part of a Corbyn ministry, they proceeded to say, well, you know, I'll be open for that. But the very people who ended up starting to join the ministry started showing signs of dissent very early on. So, for example, the whole fracas about whether he sang the national anthem or not, of course, at the
yes.
commemoration, you know, of the Battle of Britain, the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Britain. And, of course, he did not sing. He wasn't exactly beating his chest and going hell for leather about the, you know, about the national anthem. And so, of course, some individuals took it as a chance to attack him and say that this was a distinctly unpatriotic gesture. And, of course, what was saddening within Labour Party ranks was that some of those were from the Labour front bench, and they made it explicitly clear, firstly, that they would support the expansion of strikes on Syria, which Corbyn opposes, you know, and, of course, secondly, opposed and would oppose any compromise on Trident, or the disbandment of Trident, the nuclear deterrent that Britain has. And so these are the sorts of things that he has to contend with within his own ranks.
Mm. So I guess finally, I just wanted to ask a question about the establishment and the strategies, the tools they have at their disposal to deal with this anti-establishment Labour leader. I mean, you mentioned the anonymous general who talked about a coup, you know, evoking 1973 Chile. What do you anticipate the establishment will use against Corbyn to defeat his aspirations?
Well, an example of what to expect in terms of trying to deal with Corbyn is the and it happened actually very recently, and some days ago, when Corbyn made the remark about what would happen in the event of a nuclear strike. And he actually openly said, and this is something that really sent shivers down the security establishment, and he said that he could never humanly envisage himself as possibly pressing the trigger. He could never press the button to launch nuclear weapons. It is a remarkable thing to say, as a potential leader of Britain, that you will not press the trigger under any circumstances. You will not press the button that would lead to a further intensification of a Holocaust, a nuclear Holocaust. A remarkable thing to say, and that is an example about how people will either scuttle his chances or enhance them. It's obvious that he is going to be elected on his word and not in spite of his word. So the question is whether that word holds true and whether it will prevail amidst the party apparatchiks and his enemies, of which there are no doubt many. And so the question then is whether this Corbyn experiment, if you like, from a range of things, be it security, be it in an economy where he's anti-austerity, so-called Corbynomics and a range of things about quantitative easing and these unpopular measures that are simply not done these days, it remains to be seen whether this will hold. I certainly have a lot of confidence that he has some energy in him to prevail, but we have to, of course, see how that ends up unfolding.
Okay. Well, Binoy Camp, Mark, I've appreciated this conversation, and I looking forward to maybe having another interview with you at some point, but it's a very enlightening conversation. Thank you for that analysis.
Always a pleasure being with you, Michael.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Hillary Clinton is now the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee for president. Less than 2 days after her victories in the California, New Jersey, South Dakota, and New Mexico primaries, President Barack Obama formally endorsed Clinton for president. Bernie Sanders told his supporters following the June 7th primaries that he intended to soldier on right until the Democratic convention in July. While Sanders has, of the time of this program is being assembled, has not formally conceded to his Democratic rival, he has signaled that he will not be running as an independent, much to the chagrin of many of his supporters, and may consider a role in a Clinton administration, possibly even as vice president. Now that the race is shaping up to be a Clinton versus Trump contest, I thought it would be a good idea to bring in prominent commentator Stephen Lendman to assess the prospects for democracy in America. Stephen Lendman is, of course, the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network and is the editor and contributor to a new book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. His blog site is sjlendman.blogspot.com, and he's also a frequent contributor to the Global Research website and a frequent guest on this program. So, Stephen Lendman, thank you once again for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's a joy to be on with you. It would be wonderful one day to have a discussion about all the wonderful things going on in the world. And unfortunately, the state of the world is not that way.
Okay, so we've got basically what this seems like the you've got the candidates that have effectively come together. I think at the outset, back maybe a year ago, people were thinking that we're not taking Donald Trump seriously and we're expecting that it would be Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush or somebody else, but not Donald Trump. But I don't know, when you look at Hillary's on the Democratic side, was there ever any real doubt in your mind that Hillary would be the chosen one?
Oh, not the slightest. I wrote in a couple of articles saying that she was chosen last year before the primary caucus season began, Michael. The real surprise was Trump emerging victorious for the GOP nomination. I mean, it really is very unusual that a candidate party bosses oppose, and they certainly opposed him, and I think there's still a lot of rumbling in the party, that he would emerge despite that. It shows, I think, a lot of people are very upset about what's going on and under the delusion of thinking that he would make a difference if he became president. You know, he speaks differently, and he says things that other candidates don't say. He sounds anti-establishment, but who ever heard of a billionaire who was anti-establishment? Does anybody ever think in those terms? Just the fact that he speaks differently doesn't mean that he would act differently. You just take a look at some of the things he says about individual issues, and the only thing I'm pleased about him, and who knows what he would do if he became president, was he's much more moderate, at least in his rhetoric about Putin and Russia, certainly than any other Republican candidate in Clinton. Now, whether he would act moderate if he became president is another issue entirely. Obama was the supreme peace candidate in 2007, 2008, Michael, and look what he's done over the last 7.5 years.
That's true. I mean, I think it's pretty much, I mean, I might cynically say it's almost part of the resume of any politician that you're going to break your promise at some point or another. And so, I mean, it seems like folly. Like Obama, I think both Obama and Clinton in 2008 were talking about ripping up NAFTA and that sort of thing. And, of course, that didn't happen either. So it seems to me that it would be folly to expect that Donald Trump would keep some of –
any of his promises, even some of the more ludicrous ones, like building a wall with Mexico.
I don't see any possibility of that happening. I don't know why he ever came up with something as nonsensical as that.
But do you think his followers expect him to break the word? Is it just that they like his style, or do they actually believe he's going to keep these promises?
Well, I think he appeals to the people who don't like the idea of undocumented immigrants whose skin color is different from their own, namely white, coming into America. I mean, they don't care about Canadians crossing the border and coming in, but they care about Mexicans or Africans or maybe Asians coming into America. So that kind of comment appeals to something like that. But you can build all the walls and the world, and you're not going to keep people from doing what they want to do. I mean, people are drowning at sea by the thousands, and they're still coming from the war zone, Syria and Afghanistan, Libya, wherever, and trying to make it to the European continent, and they'll keep doing it, and so, a lot of them will be killed, a lot of them will make it. So, yeah, I mean, you can't stop people from trying to get away from a desperate situation on the possibility that things could be better for them, even risking their lives to do it. And Mexicans risk their lives to get to America, and it's been a good while since I've written about this, but Mexicans on their own crossing on land in the summertime through the desert, there are bodies strewn across the desert of Mexicans who did not make it.
And this business about registering Muslims and keeping Muslims at bay, I mean, is that just election year blarney, or do you think he actually might mean it?
Well, America has been at war with Islam for many, many years before George W. Bush, but it certainly accelerated after 9/11. And, you know, communism is gone as America's number one enemy, so you need something replacing it. And Islam, or you could call it radical Islam, I mean, most Islam is peaceful, just like most elements of Judaism and Christianity. And if you look at the dogma of all three religions, I mean, they're virtually the same. But you've got radical elements in all religions, and certainly not just those three. You get radical Buddhists and radical people from all sorts of religions. But again, the majority are people who don't want violence, who want peace, who simply want to live normal lives. But America needs enemies, so it created the enemy of Islam to give it an excuse to wage wars against Afghanistan and the Middle East countries and so on and so forth. So that's public enemy number one. And Trump is simply following along the same principles of Bush and Obama, and but going a little bit extreme, saying he wants to keep Muslims out. Well, you know, Bush and Obama put them in prison, and Trump is saying he wants to keep them out. Well, I would bet better for them if they be kept out than to come in and be put in prison. I don't know how active that is right now, but it was very active post 9/11 with witch hunts against Muslims, and I wrote about so many individuals that were targeted unjustly and imprisoned for crimes they never committed. How much of that's going on right now, I don't know.
Well, I guess having enemies, I mean, it's not only good for the U.S. empire, but it's good for business, and Trump is ostensibly a big businessman, so you've got your...
Absolutely, and certainly wars are very good for business. If wars weren't profitable, there'd be no wars, Michael. They are so profitable, not just for the defense contractors, but all of the other companies that profit from the technology companies, the food companies, all sorts of companies profit from wars. And it's the reason America, throughout its entire history, has been at war every year, either internally or abroad or both, from before the beginning of the Republic in July 1776, before that, and every year thereafter. So even under the best of America's leaders, America has been a warrior state, and the condition it's in right now, with the super weapons that exist, I mean, we're looking at the possibility of ending life on Earth if something, I don't think anybody wants to do this intentionally, but people make mistakes, and with the kind of super weapons that exist, anything could happen. It's really terrifying.
And it seems to me, when you look at these two candidates, Hillary versus Trump, if I could locate maybe one significant difference, or maybe it isn't so significant, but Trump, being a billionaire, is not as beholden to Wall Street and the neocons as Hillary appears to be. I mean, she's kind of bought and paid for by Wall Street, so I don't see any effort to resist that agenda. So I don't know, is there anything to this... this idea of the enemy of my enemy is my friend? I mean, if you see the Wall Street imperialism, at least with Trump, and this could be why it seems as if there's you're seeing so many of these neocons like Robert Kagan and others wanting to back Hillary as opposed to Trump, because I guess Trump is too much of a wild card.
That's very true. I don't think Trump, if he was elected, would differ very much from the system that's ongoing now. I think the power brokers would cut him a little bit of slack, give him a little bit of wiggle room. You know, that's okay. You know, like you take a commission on a sale, but, you know, the big money goes to the producer of the product, the deliverer of the service. So I think he'd get a little bit of wiggle room, but not a great deal. I think the endless wars would continue. I think the support for big business in Wall Street would continue. The police state laws would stay in place, and heaven knows what else he might institute. And I always say, forget the rhetoric of the politicians. Watch only what they're doing. So literally, you have to ignore everything that Bush ever said or Obama ever said or continues to say, and just look at their policies. What do they support? What laws do they sign into? And what legislation do they sign into laws? This tells you what they really are. When it comes to Sanders, you know, a rhetorical populist, but if you look at his record in the House and Senate, he votes with other Democrats 98% of the time. So what does that tell you?
You just mentioned Sanders. I'm going to play a little bit of audio from after his meeting with Obama. So this just took place over the yesterday, I believe it was. So here's what he said to his supporters.
I am going to do everything in my power, and I will work as hard as I can to make sure that Donald Trump does not become president of the United States. I spoke briefly to Secretary Clinton on Tuesday night, and I congratulated her on her very strong campaign. I look forward to meeting with her in the near future to see how we can work together to defeat Donald Trump and to create a government which represents all of us and not just the 1%. Thank you very much.
Okay, so I don't know if you managed to hear all of that, but...
I did. So, I quoted some of that in an article I put out today. If that doesn't sound like a concession and subservience to Hillary Clinton and the likelihood that Obama will be offered a position in her administration, probably a high-level one, maybe as vice president, and I would imagine whatever he's offered, he will accept.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, do you think there's anything to this idea of being able to exert influence within the administration, maybe tame things down a little bit? His comments about the fighting the forces of Wall Street and whatever,
I would say the chances are zero.
Yeah, I mean,
there's no chance in the world. Sanders' record, again, in the House and Senate, is he basically goes along with most of the policies. The one that particularly gnawed at me was Obamacare. When I spoke to one of the people one of his people in his office at the time when he voted for Obamacare. But the story on that was he was the only member of Congress to and in the Senate, of course, to introduce. A universal health care bill, the only one, and his rhetoric all along until the vote came along was supporting universal health care. And then he was pressured to go along with Obamacare, which is nothing but a health rationing scheme, enriching the big health care providers, the insurers and the drug companies and the hospital chains. And his vote, he didn't just support it, his vote was the difference between it being enacted or it being defeated. Literally, Michael, his vote was the deciding vote, and he went the wrong way, showing that he supported big business and he didn't care about giving proper health care, let alone universal health care, to ordinary people. And Obamacare really is an abomination.
Now, there was an article, I'm sure you're familiar with it, in Black Agenda report by managing editor Bruce Dixon. And yeah. He referred to Mr. Sanders as the sheepdog in the Democratic Party race. He says that, going back decades, you've always had what they call sheepdog candidates. You know, there's Jesse Jackson in 1984 and 88, and Jerry Brown in 1992, Al Sharpton in 2000 and 2004. In 2008, it was Dennis Kucinich. What he means by a sheepdog candidate is that you give left activists and voters a reason to believe that there's a place of influence within the Democratic Party. And when the eventual Democratic nominee is decided by early summer, so it's too late to try to organize an independent race through an independent candidate. Would you go along with that idea, that description of Bernie Sanders and why he was allowed to run and he may perhaps even encouraged to run over the course of this race?
Well, I think the party needed somebody to run against Hillary Clinton, and Sanders certainly was eager and willing to do that. It wouldn't be Clinton was anointed to be the Democrat nominee. And, Michael, I always refer to the party as the Democrat Party, not the Democratic Party, because there's nothing Democratic about it. So I go out of my way to use the Democrat word instead of Democratic. But it wouldn't be much of a campaign if Clinton had no opponent. So Sanders was willing and went along with it, played the game. I'm certain he knew from the outset he had no chance of being the nominee, whether he realized fully that Clinton was anointed as of last year. They both declared, I believe, on the same day last year, April 15th, 2015, the income tax day of all days. Why they picked that day, I don't know, long time ago. And Sanders, again, the rhetoric all along has been populist and so on and so forth. He's never really taken Clinton to task on the most important things you need to criticize her for. Her absolutely subservience to Wall Street, her support for the imperial wars, every one of them, from Afghanistan, the U.S. Senator, when the Afghan war was launched, and, of course, the Syrian war and the Libyan war and deposing governments in Honduras and Paraguay, and all the other horrors that she's been associated with. He's never taken her to task in no uncertain words about that. If you wanted to be an honest candidate, then you ought to be able to present her case honestly. But he's held back. He's held back because he knew that the ending of the process would be she'd get the nomination, and then he would have to look like he has to support her, which he will. And instead of saying nasty things about her, he'll say supportive words about her, going after Trump as the bad guy and building Clinton up as the good one, but saying he'll support her because he doesn't want to support the 1%. Well, what the heck does Clinton support? Clinton is part of the 1%, every bit as much as Trump is.
There is at least one other party running, and that's the Green Party and Jill Stein. What are your thoughts about her and the Green Party? Is it a lost cause? Is it worth supporting? What do you see in terms of being an instrument of some sort of democratic change?
I think Jill Stein is the real thing, but independent parties in America don't have a chance to go anywhere. The last one that came close to getting any kind of popular support was Ross Perot running against George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton in 1992. We got about 20% of the vote. And you got to go back a ways to see other independent candidates getting any kind of support. I think Teddy Roosevelt once ran in the Bull Moose Party. I'm going to check my facts on that over a century ago. But an independent has never won in America, and especially today. I mean, the system is entirely rigged. You got a duopoly system, a one-party state with two wings, literally. And they take turns deciding who will run the Congress, who will run the administration. And that's the way the dirty game is played. But there really isn't much of a difference between the two parties. On the major issues, Michael, they differ on some things. You know, one might go for stem cell research, another might be against it. But when it comes to war and peace and corporate empowerment and police state laws cracking down on people who don't believe in the system, they're absolutely 100% in lockstep. And Sanders, I believe, supports this ugly system, even though his rhetoric suggests otherwise.
Well, I mean, whatever you might think about Sanders himself, there is this movement of individuals behind him who I tend to think are for the most part sincere and authentic in their desire to and they are saying they're not, a lot of them, if not the majority, they're not going to back Hillary Clinton. So what would you be inclined, what do you think will become of them? Are they just going to kind of evaporate? Are they going to possibly throw their support behind Jill Stein? Or where do you think things will go from this point for the supporters?
Of course, Jill Stein has no chance of winning. I mean, she'd be lucky to get 500,000 votes, and if she got 1 million, that would really be exceptional. She's a physician, and in one of my articles writing about her, I said something like she wanted to use her healing skills to heal the country. And I think she'd be a marvelous president, except for one thing. If she ever became president and tried to institute the policies she believes in, she'd have a JFK ending. They'd kill her. They'd get rid of her. So, you know, this is the way the system is. There's no possibility of changing this. I think the idea of changing the U.S. system at the ballot box is an exercise in futility. The only possibility of change is for people to decide on their own that they're not going to take it anymore and have a nonviolent revolution, which would almost change France in 1968, where literally the country was shut down for a number of weeks, especially in May 1968, and the De Gaulle government was on the ropes, literally on the ropes. It could have fallen, and the energy waned. It wasn't sustained, and because of that, the whole thing collapsed. You see this stuff going on in France right now, and probably the same ending will happen now. But if people conducted a campaign like this and stayed out in the streets and kept protesting honestly, and I believe nonviolently, and they simply refused to quit until they got the justice they deserved, then something good could happen. People could never get exactly what they wanted, but you could change this ugly system. If we could just end these imperial wars, Michael, and save the world from the possibility of a nuclear holocaust, that alone would be a major achievement.
Well, you mentioned things like, you know, people sort of taking to the streets and you know, demanding change. I think it seems to me that's what Occupy Wall Street attempted to do. And
yes.
What was the upshot of that?
Again, the energy wanes. Of course, whenever a activism like this sprouts up, it's attacked. It's attacked in different ways. It's attacked federally, attacked statewide, citywide, and we see what happens. You know, city police just using violence against these people. City after city, Zuccotti Park, if I remember the name of the park exactly, New York cops just beating up on these activists. And finally, you know, you take so much of this and the energy wanes. It was amazing how this thing just got so energetic in such a short period of time, spreading across the country like an uncontrollable wildfire. But yet after a number of months, the energy waned and the whole thing has just collapsed. I'd like to see it reinvigorated against and be more than just anti-Wall Street. I mean, anti-Wall Street, anti-war, anti-big business, any of the kind of things that are causing so much harm. America is being third-worldized. It's a country that's resembling Guatemala. It's a police state. It's just a deplorable situation. America was far from beautiful when I was young growing up in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s. It was just a different country then. It's flawed and blemished as it was back then. But and I was in the Army, but thankfully I was in the Army during a time of peace, never sent overseas to a war zone, never feared for my life. And service was mandatory in those days, so you had to serve in some capacity unless you were physically unable, 4F as they called it back then. But today it's completely different, and we've got a situation where endless wars wage in multiple theaters. We've got nuclear weapons, we've got other super weapons, and we've got neocons in Washington, bipartisan neocons in the Republican and Democrat Party, that by a mistake of design could literally launch something that could cross a Rubicon of no return, and heaven help us all if that happens. I mean, I don't know that it will happen, but the threat is there, and nothing is being done to defuse it.
Just wanted to kind of, you know, just inspect that point that you're making about the way the electoral system is simply not a route to justice, because I mean, I plan to run this interview in conjunction with another interview I did some time ago about Jeremy Corbyn, who is he's the leader, the newly elected leader of the Labour Party. And I don't know, he seems to be what you'd say the real deal. I mean, he seems to have the right stance on a lot of issues. I think he even got attacked by Tony Blair not very recently over his stance on Syria. Is there not a prospect of, I mean, maybe Bernie Sanders was not quite the right example, but in the UK, could someone like Jeremy Corbyn possibly be someone worth rallying behind, or is that a lost cause?
I don't think rallying behind an individual is going to do anything. I think you need a movement. You need a movement with good leadership. Corbyn could be a good leader. Martin Luther King certainly was a wonderful leader for civil rights. I don't see anybody in America that has the leadership stature. I mean, Muhammad Ali would be a wonderful leader if we could resurrect him and restore his youth to get out there and be anti-war and pro-civil rights and so on. Somebody with the prominence to influence. It's a lot of people, but of course we don't have them, and I'm not aware of anybody in America that has the prominence or the stature or the interest in getting out and leading a movement for the kind of justice and anti-war and pro-populism that we need. And Sanders certainly is not that individual. He's literally caved throughout his political career, saying one thing and end up doing something entirely different. I've never trusted him for going back a good many years. I simply don't trust him. I don't trust them now, and I expect them to become part of the Clinton administration, which would be the ultimate sellout to his supporters.
Mm. So you've got a kind of a situation where, I mean, the structure of power is when you have these establishment figures, they're effectively representing the corporate entities, and what you want in terms of people power is something more along the lines of the labor movement or the union movement, so that you've got that sort of dance between the forces of the corporations and the forces of labor, and you know that way, you know that you may not be able to elect one of your own, but you can keep them in check through the forces of popular mobilization. Does that make sense to you?
Oh yeah, it certainly does. I wish I could live long enough to see something happen that could really give me the idea that change was possible. I'm getting up in years. I don't think I have enough years left to see the kind of change I dream of. I mean, I'd be delighted just to see the kind of country I grew up in return, which we certainly don't have now. I never heard of the term neocon back when I was going to school, college and graduate school in the 1950s. When things were so much different than they were today, when a Republican meant an Eisenhower Republican, and today it means a Trump or a George W. Bush or a Jeb Bush. Earlier you mentioned talking about the unlikelihood of Trump becoming the nominee. I really expected Jeb Bush. You mentioned Jeb Bush earlier. I really expected him to be the Republican nominee, and it's really astonishing how his campaign just collapsed. But that really amazes me.
Okay. Well, Stephen, I have enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure we'll have you back at some point for more commentary, perhaps as the election day comes closer. That is, if you don't decide to leave the country by then. But, Stephen,
to go where, Michael, to go where.
True enough. Stephen Lendman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, we've been joined by Stephen Lendman. He is the host of the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network, and you can find his blog site at sjlendman.blogspot.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.